Chapter 72. In the days that followed, Mary and Mr. Haywood walked with the gardeners on the less demanding fells, strolling about the green shores of the lake, and riding on the little local ponies who carried them without complaint over the tough, marshy grass of the valley paths. The more they were together, the tighter the bond between them seemed to become, strengthened with every conversation, every shared smile, every small gesture. Mary began to think Mr. Haywood must intend to declare himself, for what else could all his attention and fondness imply, if not a desire to be married? It is very common for people who have just discovered themselves to be in love to imagine none but themselves can see their deepest feelings writ plain on their faces. And Mary was no exception to this rule. She was confident her happiness was apparent to her alone, but it was hardly to be expected that her aunt would not notice. Mrs. Gardiner had watched approvingly as her niece and Mr. Haywood grew ever closer. She and her husband could imagine no better outcome than that Mary should be united to their friend, and their pleasure in the likely coming together of the two young people was unaffected and sincere. Until now, Mrs. Gardiner had been extremely circumspect in expressing any opinion about Mary's situation. But now she began to feel matters were sufficiently advanced to allow some comment upon it. She gently encouraged Mary to look favourably upon Mr. Haywood, reminding her of his good nature, so essential in a companion, his kindness, his lively intelligence, and his solid prospects in the law, which were so much enhanced by his recent success. With a host of such delicate brushstrokes, Mrs. Gardiner contrived to paint a picture of Tom Haywood as the very model of a suitable husband for her niece. Mary liked nothing better than to hear Mr. Haywood praised, and was not afraid to let Mrs. Gardiner see the pleasure she took in hearing him admired. She said little in reply, but secretly she was delighted by Mrs. Gardiner's words. They suggested her aunt also thought it likely Mr. Haywood would propose to her, and that thrilled her with a pleasurable apprehension she had never felt before. Mr. Haywood was in equally good spirits, pleased with every new hill and valley, talkative, amusing, always ready to please. As a result, their little quartet soon took on an exceptionally cheerful character, tinged with the expectation that even greater happiness might be anticipated if matters turned out in the way everyone seemed to hope that they would. They were all in an excellent humour, disposed to try anything that might add to their pleasure, so that when, one night at dinner, Mr. Haywood mentioned that he had a new excursion to propose, he was heard with the keenest attention. "I have been thinking about Miss Bennet's desire to view the sea from the top of one of the great hills around us," he began. "And the more I read, the more I am convinced she is right to want to attempt it. The prospects are said to be quite breathtaking, unlike anything else the lakes afford." He brushed the crumbs on the tablecloth to one side with his napkin, produced his copy of The Guide to the Lakes, and laid it carefully before him. "Mr. Wordsworth says there are only a few places which offer such a view, and it appears we are lucky enough to be near one. It seems to me this is too good an opportunity to be ignored, and that perhaps we might think of walking up it." He handed the guide to the gardeners, opened at the appropriate pages. "As you can see, it involves a climb up one of the hills. Its name is Scafell, and it promises the most extraordinary sights from the top." "But Tom," cried Mrs. Gardiner, looking up with horror from the little book, "it says here Scafell is one of the highest peaks in England. Mr. Wordsworth calls it a mountain."
"He does," admitted Mr. Haywood. "But if you read a little further, you'll see that it is not as demanding a walk as its height suggests. The path ascends very gradually, and if the weather is kind, the view from the summit is the finest you can imagine. On a brilliant day, you can see all the way to Scotland."
"That must be magnificent," declared Mary. "A true natural wonder."
"And it would not be necessary to go all the way to the top to see it. Look, Mr. Wordsworth prints a letter here from a friend who has walked it, and says the views are just as spectacular from a much lower ridge. That, I think, we might reasonably try to reach."
Mrs. Gardiner, still doubtful, handed the book to Mary,
who fell upon it with all the enthusiasm her aunt lacked.
"Yes," she said. "Even from the lower height, it is possible to see the Solway Firth, and in the other direction, we could gaze upon the mountains of Wastdale in tumult. We should be in the very midst of one of Mr. Wordsworth's poems."
She shut the book and turned to Mr. Hayward. "How could we go home without having seen such a sight?" Mrs. Gardiner, however, was unmoved.
"I suppose it may be done by gentlemen, but I cannot believe it is suitable for ladies."
Mr. Hayward took up the guide again.
"I have it on the best authority that, although he does not name her, the writer of the letter describing the climb was none other than Mr. Wordsworth's sister. She went up with a woman friend and their female servant, and they made it to the very top, far farther than we should go, without coming to any harm."
"But," protested Mrs. Gardiner, "they may be experienced walkers, regular mountain goats."
She turned to her husband.
"Do you think we should attempt it?"
"Well, it is a tempting prospect. The chance to see something so remarkable is not to be easily given up."
He picked up the wine bottle and poured the remains of the claret into their glasses.
"But I appreciate your concerns. Before we decide anything, we shall take proper advice. In the morning, we will discuss it with the innkeeper and hear his opinion."
Later, as Mary brushed out her hair by the light of a single candle, she felt nothing but pleasurable anticipation for what was to come. She did not doubt Mr. Hayward would have his way, and they should soon find themselves on a majestic peak with a distant view of the sparkling sea. She went to sleep quickly, and although a few hours later she was woken by the rumble of a coach as it pulled into the courtyard and the irritable complaints of the servants called out to attend it, the noise did not really disturb her. She was soon asleep once more, quite indifferent to the bustle of the late arrivals and the fretful impatience with which they found their way to their beds. Chapter 73. The Scafell trip was the principal subject of conversation amongst everyone the next morning. Mrs. Gardiner was not at all certain she should go. She did not think she could bear the heights. She supposed Mary might attempt it, but only if a pair of good boots could be procured for her, and a guide. They must take a knowledgeable guide. So intense was their interest in the walk and the practicalities attached to it, that when the innkeeper approached their table, Mary thought it must be to discuss the excursion. In fact, he brought a letter for Mr. Hayward. It appeared one of the guests who arrived so late last night had asked for him by name, and on discovering he was here, had sat down and written it there and then. Mr. Hayward took the note and read it with such surprise that Mrs. Gardiner asked him if it contained bad news.
No, nothing of that kind. But it is very unexpected. Let me read it to you.
"My dear Tom, I dare say you will be as astonished to receive this letter as I am to be writing it. I have been occupied for a few weeks now with some family business in Kent. When it was resolved, I headed for London, wanting nothing so much as good company, preferably your own, only to find that you were gone. I then remembered what Miss Bennet told me, that you had travelled north with the worthy Gardiners. When I recalled the excitement with which she talked about it, I decided that very minute to join you. There was nothing to keep me in town, and I have long wished to see for myself the country which inspired that poetic genius we both revere. So, to cut my story short, I at once took off. I guessed you would be following that great man's guide, so I directed myself to all the inns he recommends. I drew a blank at the first two, but at the third, I was rewarded. I understand my sudden arrival must be a surprise. I only hope it will be a pleasant one, and I'm sure you will be delighted to hear that I do not come alone. Miss Bingley and Mr. and Mrs. Hurst have happily consented to be my guests on this jaunt. I'm sure you will think this as great an advantage as I do myself, and that we may find ourselves to be a very companionable little party. William Ryder." "Well, Tom," declared Mrs. Gardiner, "your friend is clearly a most enterprising young man."
"Well, I'm not sure what to say," he replied.
"I can only apologise for his inviting himself to join us in this way. I can't imagine what provoked him to do so."
"I'm sure there's no harm done," said Mr. Gardiner. "I suppose we may see as much or as little of them as we wish. and perhaps the presence of new people will stop us becoming too set in our ways."
He smiled encouragingly around the table, but met with little enthusiasm in return. Mr. Haywood's expression did not suggest that he welcomed any additions to their number, and Mrs. Gardiner, who had no love for either the Hursts or Caroline Bingley, looked equally severe. Mary was troubled by Mr. Ryder's having mentioned her name. Was his arrival in some way her fault? If she had not described their trip to him with such excitement, perhaps the idea of following them would never have occurred to him. "I am very sorry if I spoke about our plans to Mr. Ryder with too much eagerness. I assure you I gave him no reason to believe he should join us." Mrs. Gardiner instantly declared that it was nonsense even to think of such a thing. Her husband patted Mary's arm and told her she fretted far too much. Mr. Haywood, however, did not speak, but picked up the letter and studied it closely, as if attempting to extract some hidden meaning from it. No more was said on the subject, and shortly after, Mr. Gardiner and Mr. Haywood excused themselves and went in search of the innkeeper to find out his opinion about the Scafell walk. Once they were gone, Mrs. Gardiner reached for the last of the hot rolls. "These are really very good. I'm only glad we have so much walking to look forward to, or my figure would never survive them." She spread her butter more thickly than she was used to doing at home and began to eat with every appearance of enjoyment. "You don't seem very happy at the prospect of our unexpected visitors." "We have been so happy and comfortable together," said Mary, "that I find it hard to imagine our enjoyment will be improved by additions. I confess it requires more good nature than I possess to think kindly of Miss Bingley, and the Hursts have little more to recommend them." Mrs. Gardiner put down what remained of her roll and poured herself more tea. "I wonder, is it only the presence of the two wicked sisters that disturbs you, or does Mr. Ryder's arrival have a similar effect?" For a moment, all that could be heard was the clatter of plates as the inn servants cleared the other tables. "Mr. Ryder? I'm not sure I understand. Why should he disturb me?" "I think he likes you. And the obvious, undisguised liking of a handsome man is a very unsettling experience." Mary tried to protest, but her aunt held up her hand. "It provokes all manner of emotions, especially when that man is being pursued by another woman. The knowledge that she wants something we could have with ease, if we chose to exert ourselves to obtain it, cannot help but make that object seem more valuable. And the more she shows she wants him, the more desirable he becomes." Mrs. Gardiner examined the pots of jam left on the table, took a teaspoonful of raspberry jam, and placed it delicately on the last of her roll. "I'm afraid it does not reflect very well on our sex, but there it is." "You speak very plainly." "Sometimes I think we are obliged to do so. It was clear to me in London, and to you as well, I imagine, that Miss Bingley had set her cap at Mr. Ryder. Her coming here confirms it. I don't imagine she has travelled some hundreds of miles on bad roads for the pleasure of our company." "I agree that is unlikely," admitted Mary. "She is determined to have him, if she can, and I think she sees clearly who stands in her way." "If you mean what I think you do, both you and Miss Bingley are quite wrong. I consider Mr. Ryder as a friend, nothing more. When he is absent, I am sure that is true, but you may find it harder to preserve that indifference when constantly in his company. He is a man of considerable charm. He is lively, with a very winning manner, and I imagine he is capable of speaking very persuasively about matters of the heart, unlike others who, for all their talk of sensation and emotion, struggle to say what they really feel, or indeed to act upon it." Mary felt as if a cold hand had seized her heart. She took a discarded piece of bread and began to roll it on the tablecloth. "I am not sure I understand," she ventured. "I think you know that I have grown to think very highly of Mr. Haywood. I very much hoped, I have allowed myself to imagine, that my fondness might be returned." Mary felt herself colour
as she said her most secret thought out loud. But now you seem to suggest that he may not speak, that he may not have the courage or the conviction to do so. Have I misunderstood his feelings, then? Am I wrong to believe he has some liking for me? When she looked up from the table, she seemed so desperate, so anxious, that Mrs. Gardiner reached over the table and took Mary's hand. That isn't what I meant at all, she said, her voice gentle now. It is my honest opinion that Tom cares for you very much indeed. I have observed 1,000 little evidences that suggest it. But I have known him for very many years now, long enough to know that beneath the playful, confident surface he presents to the world, there is hidden a much more diffident young man. He is not at all as certain of himself as he likes to suggest. There is a delicacy about him, a lack of presumption, if you like, that causes him to hold back where others have no such reservations. She withdrew her hand, and noticing she had left a smudge of jam on Mary's fingers, attempted to dab it off with her napkin. I truly did not mean to imply that Tom does not feel real affection for you, but I suspect he may be slower and more cautious to act upon it than those with more impetuous natures. I wished only to warn you that those who speak with the greatest freedom about their emotions are not always those who feel most deeply. I should not like to see Tom fall at the last hurdle, as Mr. Hurst might have it, because others are more fluent and more persuasive in making their case. Mary drew back, shocked. You cannot really think I would behave like that. No, replied Mrs. Gardiner, I don't believe you would ever intend to do so, but we are told that hope deferred makes the heart sick, and in such a situation the appeal of a man like Mr. Ryder might be very dangerous. I would not say any of this if I thought he might suit you, she continued, but I believe you will only ever be happy with a man whose affections are as strong and steady and unalterable as your own, and sometimes men of that character act more slowly than their rivals. Before Mary could reply, a servant appeared at their table and asked permission to clear their plates. Neither she nor her aunt spoke again until it was done, when Mrs. Gardiner rose from the table and came to sit next to her niece. As usual, you have borne my lecturing with the greatest patience, she said, and I will not tease you with my opinions again, but I do beg you, do think about what I have said. The man who declares his affections most readily is not necessarily the man who feels them most profoundly. Mary was about to exclaim that her aunt's warnings were quite misplaced, that she was quite immune to Mr. Ryder's powers, but before she could do so, Mr. Gardiner and Mr. Hayward returned to the table.
All is decided, announced Mr. Gardiner triumphantly. The innkeeper assures us that the walk to the lower ridge of Scafell is quite manageable in fine weather, and he can provide a guide, a steady, sober man who knows the path well and will take no foolish risks.
He says it will take the better part of a morning to reach the ridge, said Mr. Hayward. So if we leave the inn promptly and the weather is kind to us, we might catch a sight of the sea by midday.
He looked expectantly at Mary, but she was distracted, her mind still turning upon Mrs. Gardiner's words.
Imagine it, Miss Bennet. We should see for ourselves what Mr. Wordsworth saw, stand exactly where he stood.
I should like that very much, she replied, rallying her spirits. But would it not be correct to say where she stood? For you told us it was Mr. Wordsworth's sister who made the ascent described in the guide.
You are quite right, said Mr. Hayward, relieved that Mary appeared to have recovered her enthusiasm for the trip. I am very happy to tread in the footsteps of a lady, especially one as intrepid as Miss Wordsworth.
Mr. Gardiner laughed.
It sounds as though enthusiasm alone will be enough to carry you two up the hill. The rest of us may be obliged to make use of a stick.
And a pair of proper boots, added Mrs. Gardiner. I cannot think of your going without them.
Chapter 74 The Gracechurch Street party spent the rest of the day walking on mild and undemanding hills, rehearsing, as Mr. Hayward had it, for their grand excursion.
As they marched down green paths and strolled along the banks of fast-flowing becks, Mary applied herself to studying Mr. Hayward's behaviour towards her, attempting, in the most disinterested way, to gauge the warmth of his feelings for her. She did all she could to be sceptical, but everything about his bearing suggested the strongest attachment. His conversation, his smiles, his many considerate attentions. When he presented her with a sprig of honeysuckle to wear in her hat, she thought the matter settled. Gradually, the uncertainties raised in her mind by Mrs. Gardiner's words ebbed away. Mary did not think her hopes would be deferred, or not for very much longer. She had every reason to believe Mr. Hayward would declare himself before they went back to London. The Walkers took best advantage of the fine weather to be out for most of the day, so it was not until they came down to dinner that they finally found themselves in the company of Mr. Ryder and his companions. When they entered the inn's public room, Mr. Ryder, who had clearly been waiting for them there, rushed to greet them. He first approached Mrs. Gardiner to beg forgiveness for his presumption.
"Madam, I must apologise for intruding upon you in this way, but really there was no help for it. The prospect of seeing you all here in this illustrious place was too strong to be resisted. My only hope is that we might add to your pleasure, or at least not materially diminish it."
"I'm sure that would be impossible," she replied evenly. Pleased, Mr. Ryder turned his brilliant smile on Mary.
"I cannot imagine, Miss Bennet, that when we last met in Cheapside you expected to see me again so quickly. But once you had put the idea of the lakes into my head, I could not dislodge it. So here we are, and from what I have seen so far on our journey, it has all been worth it."
He was so eager to please that it required real effort to resist his enthusiasm.
"And Tom, what about you? I must ask your indulgence too."
He seized Mr. Hayward's hand and shook it robustly.
"I hear you have won a famous victory in the courts, that you carry all before you in the legal world. I cannot say I'm surprised. I expected no less, but I'm very glad of it, and offer my heartiest congratulations."
Mr. Hayward thanked him, a little self-conscious at the exuberance of his friend's praise. "But really, Will," he continued, "what are you about? 300 miles is a long way to come on a whim, especially on roads such as those hereabouts."
"I should not call it a whim," declared Mr. Ryder, "for that makes it seem like a foolish indulgence. No, I should prefer to think of it as inspired decisiveness. The idea occurred, I acted upon it, and my wish was instantly gratified."
"Do you always pursue what you want with such vigour?" asked Mary.
"Invariably," replied Mr. Ryder.
"Will believes anything is to be had by asking for it," laughed Mr. Hayward.
"Nothing ventured, Tom, nothing gained. I'm sure you've heard that said before."
"Indeed I have, mostly by you."
Mary watched the two young men talking with the easy facetiousness of an old friendship, until Mr. Ryder announced that he had taken the liberty of ordering dinner for them all. He had bespoke the best dishes the inn had to offer, a good joint of beef, and cheesecakes to follow, and very much hoped that would please. When he saw that it did, he shepherded them to a small private room where a long table was set with a clean white cloth, behind which sat, rather stiffly, the other members of Mr. Ryder's party, looking a little less delighted with their situation than their affable host.
"You will remember Mr. and Mrs. Hurst, I trust,"
declared Mr. Ryder, as they entered the room, "and Miss Bingley, of course." Mary was apprehensive as the necessary formalities were exchanged. She and Miss Bingley had parted on very bad terms after Mr. Ryder's supper, and she could not be sure how much resentment that lady would now choose to display. Mary hoped there would be no open snub, for then her aunt would notice and explanations would be required. Miss Bingley looked as she always did, perfectly dressed and as imposing as ever. Her eyes swept over Mary with her usual assessing air, as though she had not yet resolved exactly how to treat her. Then, having made up her mind, she favoured her with a cool nod. So, that was how it would be, thought Mary. A pretence of politeness, but no outward breach. That was a relief.
"I hope your journey northwards was not too trying," she began, intending to convey her own willingness to make no reference to what had passed between them. It is a long way to come, but the beauties of the country make it more than worthwhile.
It was no trouble to me, replied Miss Bingley. I have long wished to see the place that gave birth to such magnificent verse. A few inconveniences along the way are a small price to pay.
Do you read poetry, then? I did not know you cared for it.
It is a passion I share only with my friends.
Miss Bingley looked over Mary's head and stared about the room as if hoping to discover some more interesting person with whom to converse. Briefly, she caught Mr. Ryder's eye, favouring him with a charming smile which vanished when she turned back to Mary.
As soon as Ryder mentioned this trip, I told him he could not be allowed to go alone. My desire to see the lakes was quite as strong as his own and must be gratified. He straightway declared he should not think of leaving without me, and Mr. and Mrs. Hurst, of course.
That must have been very pleasing.
Yes, but I was not surprised. Ryder has often said he never enjoys an excursion if I am not amongst the party.
Well, replied Mary, evenly, I hope you will both find much to please you here. We have already seen many very fine views, and the boat trip upon the lake at Grasmere is not to be missed. I can't remember when I saw something quite so lovely.
It sounds perfect for people with mild, comfortable tastes. But as I've said to Ryder, I hope to see something rather more exciting. I have no wish to confine myself to the usual sights.
I think you will find, said Mary, determined not to rise to Miss Bingley's provocations, that even the more familiar prospects have much to recommend them. I have yet to see anything I haven't admired. Everything has delighted me.
I don't doubt that for a minute,
murmured Miss Bingley, making no effort to disguise her desire to bring their conversation, such as it was, to an immediate end.
Anyway, unless you have any suggestions of the wilder, untamed variety to offer, you know the sort of thing, I think I will go and see if anything in that line has yet occurred to Mr. Ryder.
Before Mary could reply, Miss Bingley drifted away to the other side of the room, stationing herself as close to Mr. Ryder as propriety would allow. Once she was gone, Mr. Haywood appeared at Mary's side.
It is neither polite nor generous of me to say so, but I'm afraid I don't care much for Miss Bingley.
She is not very agreeable, admitted Mary.
At least she never has been so to me. She affects a very superior air. I shouldn't be surprised if she ordered me to bring her another glass of wine or fetch her cloak. I don't think she considers me worth the effort of good manners.
He watched disapprovingly over the table as Miss Bingley indulged in her favourite ploy, plucking at Mr. Ryder's sleeve in a manner intended to suggest charming playfulness. To win her good opinion, Mary mused, you would need to be in possession of at least £10,000 a year. She would not look at you without it. A servant entered, bearing several bottles, which he placed one by one on the sideboard. The room, which was small, now began to feel crowded. Mary and Mr. Haywood were obliged to move into a corner to carry on their conversation, which he seemed keen to continue. "And what about you, Miss Bennet?" he asked. "Do you feel the same? Do you think marital happiness depends on a healthy deposit in the bank?"
Lizzie used to say it was only when she first caught sight of Pemberley that she realised how much she loved Mr. Darcy.
She had hoped to make him smile, but his face fell, and Mary saw she had misjudged his mood.
Oh, she meant it as a joke, of course. If you saw them together, you'd understand the impossibility of thinking otherwise. His wealth, his elevated situation, well, it is a long story, but neither had anything to do with the love she felt for him.
Mr. Haywood did not appear convinced.
I imagine there are few women with sufficient strength of character to be entirely indifferent to the promise of a great house and a vast income.
And few men either, retorted Mary, a little vexed now, to hear her sex disparaged even by Mr. Haywood. I have not observed any reluctance amongst male suitors to carry off an heiress, if they can.
Mr. Haywood's severe expression melted, and he laughed.
No, you have me there. Men certainly cannot claim the high ground in these matters.
but I must admit to some envy for those amongst us who are so startlingly well provided for. I'm afraid I shall never be such a catch as Mr. Darcy in the famous grounds of Pemberley.
There may indeed be some women for whom that would be a consideration, Mary said quietly. But I promise you, Mr. Haywood, not all of us think in such a way.
She looked at him expectantly and thought he seemed about to speak, when suddenly the dining-room door was pushed open and the innkeeper strode through, carrying the beef under a tremendous covered dish. Two maids followed behind, bearing plates of vegetables and a large jug of gravy. As everyone made their way to the table to begin upon their supper, Mary knew there was no chance now of hearing Mr. Haywood's response to her words.
Chapter 75. Mr. Ryder took his duties as host of the little dinner with great seriousness, and exerted himself tirelessly to thaw the remaining reserve of the Gracechurch Street party. He listened to Mr. Gardiner's fishing stories with every appearance of interest, begged Mrs. Gardiner to tell him more about the butterflies she had seen on her last walk, and encouraged Mary to recount the pleasures of their recent outing on the lake. When she had finished, he raised his glass to her.
"Well done, Miss Bennet. You describe it brilliantly. I see it perfectly through your eyes. It is as if I was there myself."
From across the table, Mrs. Gardiner caught Mary's eye, but Mary refused to respond.
"I did not catch quite everything you said, Miss Bennet," said Mr. Hurst. "I missed the part about the islands. Could I beg you to repeat it, please?"
"Perhaps on another occasion," interrupted Miss Bingley. "I'm not sure I'm ready to sit through it again, illuminating as it no doubt was."
"Do you have any sketches or drawings you made on the lake?" asked Mr. Ryder. "I'm afraid my talent doesn't lie that way," confessed Mary. "I am no great hand with a pencil."
"What a shame," said Miss Bingley. "I should have longed to see them otherwise."
Mr. Ryder indicated to the servants that the plates could now be cleared and more wine brought in.
"I must say," he declared, "your stories have properly whetted my appetite. Do you have another adventure planned, or must we consult Mr. Wordsworth's guide?" "As a matter of fact," replied Mr. Gardiner, "there is an excursion we've been considering. It promises amazing sights, but requires a great deal of stamina on the part of the walkers. Tom, why don't you say more?"
Everyone fell silent as Mr. Haywood described the Scafell climb, outlining the drama of the ascent, the wild beauty of the landscape to be passed through, and the majestic prospects to be enjoyed once they had reached the ridge. When he began upon the view of the sea with which they would be rewarded if their climb was successful, Mr. Ryder declared he had heard enough. His mind was made up. If it were left to him, they should set out tomorrow or the next day at the very latest. Mr. Haywood, who was used to his friend's enthusiasms, waited until his excitement had diminished a little before commenting mildly that it was not a trip to be undertaken lightly, for although the path itself was not too steep, it was long and strenuous and said to be rocky. "But," he continued, "the landlord here has recommended a trustworthy guide. He assures us that if his advice is followed in all things, there is no reason why it should not be attempted."
"Then surely everything is settled," cried Mr. Ryder. "Why did we come here if not to experience adventures such as this? If we are too faint-hearted to try it, we had far better have remained at home. Come, Tom, when do we set out?"
"Not before we have made proper preparations," replied Mr. Haywood firmly. "Yes, we are here to experience adventures, but not to fall victim to them. I have walked a little on the fells nearby and have seen how harsh and difficult they can be."
"Mr. Haywood would rather we confined ourselves to smooth lakes and the calmest of views," murmured Miss Bingley. "I am with Mr. Ryder. I'm sure I long to stand on the top of a mountain."
"You misunderstand me," replied Mr. Haywood severely. "I am keen for anyone who wishes it to walk up the fell, but no one should attempt it who does not appreciate the risks, or who will not take trouble to prepare for them."
"Ah," exclaimed Mr. Ryder, "there speaks the cautious lawyer. My dear Tom, we are a long way from Chancery Lane, thank God.
Let us not bring its dusty, tedious habits to the very place we have come to escape them. Come, what would Wordsworth say?
He would urge you on, as I do.
Mr. Hayward said no more, and Mary saw he was stung by his friend's suggestion that he was dull and unenterprising. Once the dinner was over and everyone had begun to disperse, he approached Mary, clearly uneasy at the turn of events.
When it was just ourselves, I was not so concerned. But now we are to be a larger party, I am less certain we should attempt it. Will Ryder is my friend, and he is good-hearted and generous to a fault, but he does not consider consequences, especially if they stand in the way of the excitement of the moment. And his manner is so persuasive, he makes those who do not share his enthusiasms feel foolish for not following his example.
Yes, said Mary, I can see he is impulsive. She sensed from Mr. Hayward's preoccupied air that he was actively considering whether the climb should be abandoned. In most circumstances, she would have entirely endorsed his judgment, but on this occasion she was not so sure. If the excursion was given up, she would lose the opportunity it offered to spend time alone in his company. That alone was enough to prejudice her in its favour, but she was also aware of an excitement that had begun to grip her as she had listened to talk of the ascent. Perhaps it was the influence of the landscape around them, so harsh and yet so beautiful, that had encouraged her to imagine abandoning her habitual prudence and throwing herself headlong into the unknown. Perhaps it was the fault of Mr. Wordsworth. She had spent so long seeing the world through his eyes that now she truly longed to experience for herself the sensations he described with such passion. She only knew she very much wanted to walk up the fell and behold for herself the landscape laid out beneath her. It would be dreadful to be denied it now. But she did not think she could explain any of this to Mr. Hayward, at least not in the cramped dining room of an inn, with servants carrying dirty dishes passing them on all sides. Instead, she was circumspect.
"I understand the need for caution," she began, "and you are right to insist on our being properly prepared. But if that can be achieved, then I wonder if we should not simply take the chance. Perhaps those of us naturally inclined to prudence might benefit from being shaken up a little."
Her reply was clearly not what Mr. Hayward had expected. But before he could ask her to say more, they were joined by Mr. Ryder.
"Well, Miss Bennet, what do you say to this stride up the hill?"
"It is more than a hill," retorted Mr. Hayward. "Not quite a mountain, as I told Miss Bingley, but something in between."
"Well, whatever it is, mountain, fell or molehill, shall we climb it or not? Come, Miss Bennet, tell me your thoughts."
"I think Mr. Hayward is right to warn us of the challenges we might face," she said, choosing her words carefully. "And it is of the first importance that we take every possible care. But I confess I should like to try it. The sight of sea in the distance must be something not easily forgotten."
Mr. Ryder clapped his friend on the shoulder.
"There! Even the thoughtful Miss Bennet finds you too timid, and I would trust her judgment implicitly. No one's more so."
He looked at her admiringly. Mr. Hayward, meanwhile, seemed disconcerted. It was plain that, for all her private misgivings, he had not expected Mary to take his friend's part. Mr. Ryder went triumphantly on, oblivious to his friend's silence.
"When we reach the ridge," he declared, "as I am fully determined we shall, I intend to stand beside you, Miss Bennet, at the exact moment when you catch your first glimpse of the sea. I should not miss it for anything."
And then, without waiting for an answer, he turned to Mr. Hayward and addressed him in a very different tone.
"Tom, I wonder if I might beg the favour of a quiet word with you later tonight. There are some family matters on which I should like to ask your advice. Legal questions, you know. Perhaps we might take a glass together when everyone has gone to bed? The landlord has some decent claret hidden away which might make amends for my talking business at such an hour and in such a place."
Sometime later, when Mary followed the others upstairs, she looked over her shoulder to see the two men settle themselves in a secluded corner. The landlord brought out their bottle himself and placed it before them.
In her tiny room, once she had undressed and brushed out her hair, she lay on her bed for a while, but sleep would not come. She hardly knew what she was doing as she put on her wrap and crept down the corridor to the top of the stairs. From there, quite hidden from the sight of those in the public room, she looked down on Mr. Hayward and Mr. Ryder, who had made short work of the good wine. Mr. Ryder was speaking with great animation, whilst his friend listened intently, every now and again interrupting with what appeared to be a question. He looked sombre. Mary watched them for a while, before the ridiculousness of her position drove her back up to her bedroom, faintly disturbed, for reasons she could not explain.
Chapter 76. When the mountain guide arrived at the inn, he made an excellent first impression, his calm, sober demeanour pleasing everyone gathered to meet him. He spoke quietly, but with authority, explaining that he had taken many ladies and gentlemen up the fell without incident, and that he would be pleased to do the same for them. However, it was essential that they understood his terms. The walk was not dangerous, but it was long, and could not be hurried. A whole day must be allowed for it. His son would accompany them, bringing provisions to sustain them on the way, and most importantly, it must be clearly understood that his instructions were to be attended to in all matters concerning the climb, for he knew the country, and they did not. It was immediately agreed he should be hired at once, and the excursion was fixed to take place a few days hence. Now that the trip was definitely to happen, the excitement of the little party was palpable. When the guide left them, Mr. Ryder exclaimed that no better man could possibly have been found to take them, and Mr. Gardiner agreed, declaring that in the hands of such an honest fellow, they could not go far wrong. Mr. Ryder repeated his impatience to behold for himself the grandeur of the high crags, whilst Miss Bingley assured him of her willingness to bear any discomfort to be with him when he did so. Even the Hursts let it be known they were agreeable to giving it a try. Only Mr. Hayward, it seemed, had nothing to say. When the little group dispersed, he made his way alone into the little garden at the front of the inn, and after a few minutes, when everyone else had gone about their separate pursuits, Mary followed him. "You are very quiet," she said as she came upon him, leaning on a stone wall and staring into the distant valley. "Do you still have reservations about the climb?" He stared out into the landscape with a preoccupied air. "I am not entirely happy about it, for all the reasons I gave you earlier. But now we have an excellent guide, which must relieve your mind somewhat, and if Mr. Ryder's impetuousness still makes you uneasy, Mr. Gardiner's presence will balance him out. He would never be swayed into attempting something unsafe." "You are quite right, of course," he replied, finally turning to face her. "To be frank, Miss Bennet, the excursion is not my principal concern at present. My thoughts are elsewhere this morning." Mary was surprised to see how low-spirited he appeared. For the first time since they had met, his usual liveliness seemed quite extinguished. His obvious unhappiness touched her deeply. She longed to take his hand and beg him to confide in her, but instead she merely moved a single step nearer to him and spoke in a manner she hoped would convey the depth of her sympathy. "Is there anything I can do to help you?"
"I'm afraid not. This is a matter I must resolve for myself, but thank you." He attempted a smile with only partial success, wished her a polite good morning, and strode back towards the inn. Mary did not follow him, but took his place leaning on the wall and looking at the hills. Something had happened. She began to feel uneasy. She plucked a blade of grass from the stone wall and wove it between her fingers. Perhaps it was nothing. She did not move for some time, but stood there reflecting until the clouds came up, when she threw the grass onto the ground and went back into the inn. Mary did not see Mr. Hayward again that morning. She supposed he had gone out walking alone. The inn was quiet, most of the guests occupied elsewhere. Miss Bingley and her sister had strolled down to the lake. Mrs. Gardiner had insisted her husband lay down his fishing rod and accompany her to Keswick. Left to her own devices,
Mary fetched a book she hoped would occupy her thoughts sufficiently to prevent them returning again and again to Mr. Hayward and his unaccountable change of mood. She stationed herself on a window seat, where light streamed in from the brilliant sunshine which had burned away the clouds. She found a cushion for her back, drew up her knees, and began to read. It was here Mr. Ryder found her when he marched into the inn, fresh from a stiff walk, calling loudly for a cold drink. Once he had drunk it, downing it in a single swift gesture, he noticed Mary tucked up in her retreat. He put down his glass, and with no greeting besides pulling up a chair next to her, he peered at the book in her hands. "Evelina! A very suitable book for a young lady on her holidays." Mary swung her legs off the seat and attempted to compose herself into a more suitable attitude.
"Really, Mr. Ryder, you came upon me quite unawares.
I did not wish to disturb you. You looked quite at your ease," he replied, not in the least discomfited. "A little like a Dutch painting, with that old window behind you. Are you fond of Miss Burney's work?"
Mary straightened her collar, very aware of his gaze.
"Not especially. I have begun her many times, and have yet to reach the end of a single one of her books." She slid a slip of paper between the novel's pages to mark her place. "But I persevere. I'm determined to enjoy her if I can."
"That is a remark only you could have made," exclaimed Mr. Ryder. "You realise Miss Burney's novels are designed to entertain. They are not a task to be endured, but a pleasure to be enjoyed. If you do not like them, why do you continue with them?"
"I feel it is a failing in me not to like them as other people do. I hoped I might teach myself to appreciate them."
"That is not how pleasure works," replied Mr. Ryder gently. "It cannot be forced into being. It arises freely from our inclinations, which are not to be dragooned into following the tastes of others."
He took the book from her hand and laid it on the seat.
"It is really quite easy once you get into the habit of it. Come, let me show you how it is done. It is the most beautiful day outside. I suggest we take full advantage of it and walk about a little. Just in the fields below the inn, down to the stile and no further."
He held out his hand in invitation. Mary's first instinct was to refuse, but outside the sun shone and the birds sang. Try as she would, she did not think she and Miss Burney would ever get on. And as Mr. Ryder had, as she considered it, given her permission to dislike her book, she thought she might just as well leave Evelina alone. She knew she would like nothing better than to walk in the fresh, sweet air, and closing her ears to the voice that told her to say no, she jumped up and went to fetch her hat.
Chapter 77
Mary enjoyed their walk together. It was pleasant to feel the sun on her face, and Mr. Ryder did all he could to entertain her, describing novels he had failed to finish with such an amusing air that Mary thought she would never again blame herself for not completing a book she had begun upon, but would abandon it without the smallest twinge of guilt. It was true that he teased her once or twice, but even his playful comments suggested appreciation on his part. And on several occasions he told her, with no equivocation at all, how very pleased he was to find himself in her company. It was impossible not to be affected by such open admiration, and by the time they were on their way back up the hill to the inn, Mary was talking to him with real animation, smiling every now and then with genuine pleasure. Indeed, she was laughing at some remark of his when they rounded a bend in the path and came upon Mr. Hayward making his way down. Mary thought she glimpsed a look of surprise when he first caught sight of them, and perhaps of something else. Sadness? Displeasure? Regret? But whatever it was lasted for such short a time that afterwards she could not be sure. If Mr. Hayward had been distressed to meet her in Mr. Ryder's company, he did everything in his power not to show it.
"Tom!"
exclaimed Mr. Ryder, unconscious of any embarrassment, greeting his friend with his usual exuberance.
"How magnificent is this! The air is so pure I could drink it. I persuaded Miss Bennet to come out and share it with me. It is far too invigorating to experience alone."
"It seems to have done you good, Miss Bennet," replied Mr. Hayward gravely. "You look very blooming in the sunshine." Mary thought he looked as unhappy as he had done that morning, and her own gaiety ebbed away as she wondered once more what could have wrought such a change in him. She had often heard the phrase, "My heart went out to him," but she had never felt the truth of it so powerfully before. "It has been a very pleasurable little walk," she said, hoping he would notice her attempt to convey that it had been of very short duration. "But 20 minutes is long enough for me on such a warm day. We are heading back in search of tea. Mr. Ryder feels sure we shall find some. I hope you will come too." He was silent for a moment, as if considering the idea.
"You surely cannot refuse such a charming invitation?" asked Mr. Ryder. "I know I could not. Do come. There might even be cake."
So Mr. Hayward agreed to join them, and they walked slowly back up the hill together. On the way, they talked of travel, its pleasures and miseries, its importance in opening the eyes and broadening the mind. There was scarcely a gap in the conversation as they went on, but it was Mr. Ryder who did most of the talking. Mr. Hayward spoke now and again, but it seemed that this afternoon he had little to say. Even when they reached the inn and sat down to tea at a little round table placed for them in front of the bay window, he remained preoccupied and remote. Mary had never seen him so withdrawn. Mr. Ryder, however, chattered happily on, and when he elicited only an occasional response from his friend, he turned increasingly to Mary, regaling her with accounts of places he had already seen, before moving on to list those he had yet to explore. No gentleman, he declared, could consider himself properly educated until he had seen for himself the classical ruins of Greece. But even so, nowhere fired his imagination as much as Italy.
"Of all the countries in the world, that is the one I most long to visit."
"I understand that desire," said Mary. "Anyone who has read Mr. Gibbon must wish to see Rome."
"Yes," replied Mr. Ryder. "It must be an extraordinary thing to walk where the Caesars trod before you. But I should like to attempt the entire grand tour, to Florence, Assisi, and Venice. Anywhere, in short, where there is beauty, art, and sunshine to be had."
Mary turned to see what Mr. Hayward thought, and found him looking at them both as if trying to find an answer to a puzzle or a conundrum, a solution which somehow eluded him. "Should you like to see Italy, Mr. Hayward?" she ventured, a little tentatively. For a moment he did not answer.
"Tom," cried Mr. Ryder, "Miss Bennet asks you, do you fancy a jaunt to Italy?"
"But excuse me, I apologise, I was not attending." He gathered his thoughts. "I do not think it would be easy to arrange with the state of Europe as it is."
"A perfect Hayward answer," laughed Ryder, "in which pragmatism triumphs over passion. But I refuse to be put off. One day I shall stand on a terrace looking out at the sea, a glass of wine in my hand, toasting the setting sun."
Mr. Hayward, it appeared, had nothing to add to this, and soon, pleading letters to write, he took his leave and went away to his room. "Well," declared Mr. Ryder as he watched his friend depart,
"Tom was hardly in the best of spirits. I wonder what can have upset him."
Mary did not know, but she feared that meeting her with Mr. Ryder had not improved his mood. She wished she had not gone out walking with him. She wished even more that they had not happened upon Mr. Hayward as they returned, and that they had not been laughing when they turned that corner. Mr. Hayward did not appear for dinner, sending a note to Mrs. Gardiner attributing his absence to headache, and expressing his hope that he would be restored to them the next day. Lying in bed later that night, Mary was restless as she tried to make sense of what had been a most confusing and distressing day. She turned over in her mind every possibility that might explain Mr. Hayward's unhappiness, but could find no explanation that satisfied her. If something untoward had happened to his family, surely he should have said so. If there had been some setback in his profession, would he not have confided in Mr. Gardiner? In her heart, she knew neither of these explanations answered. Could it possibly be something to do with her? His behaviour towards her had been very strange all day, most unlike his usual easy intimacy. He had hardly spoken to her, and indeed had been very little in her company, choosing to walk alone and not to dine. Could it be that he was avoiding her? This was so appalling an idea that it chilled her to the heart. But once it had occurred to her, she could not let it alone, and spent several unhappy hours worrying away at it. It was almost dawn before she finally fell asleep, exhausted, puzzled, and anxious. After so disturbed a night, it was no surprise that she awoke late and was one of the last to come down for breakfast. There was no one at the table but Mr. Ryder and Miss Bingley, who held a book of poetry in her hand. Mr. Ryder looked pleased to see Mary. Miss Bingley did not.
"Good morning, Miss Bennet," said Mr. Ryder. "You have arrived at exactly the right moment. Miss Bingley has been asking my opinion about the poems in this little volume. I'm sure we should both like to hear your thoughts on them."
Miss Bingley looked up from her porridge, her glance as sharp as a knife.
"Oh, no, I shouldn't like to trouble her. I'm sure Miss Bennet has far loftier things to consider than a few lines of verse."
She raised her chin as if she had issued a challenge, which, in a manner of speaking, Mary supposed that she had. But Mary did not choose to cross swords with Miss Bingley this morning. "In the manner of poetry," she answered, bland as the milk she poured into her coffee, "I think advice is not usually much to the point. Where verse is concerned, our own taste is usually the best and safest guide." Miss Bingley, who quickly saw there was to be no contest, returned her attention ostentatiously to her poetry book. Mary crumbled her breakfast roll and dipped the pieces absently in her coffee, continuing the debate she had had with herself for much of the night, her mind so engaged with the subject that when the subject of her reflections himself arrived at their table, she was completely taken by surprise. His coat was damp, and under his hat, his hair glistened with droplets from the mist that was just about to be burned off by the morning sun.
"Good Lord, Tom," cried Mr. Ryder. "Have you been out already?"
"I have. Nothing clears one's thoughts so much as a brisk walk."
"Was your mind clouded, then?" asked Mary. "Was there some decision you were obliged to make?"
He took off his hat, shook off his coat, sat down, and helped himself to coffee. "Yes, something of considerable importance. It has troubled me a great deal, but I have come to a conclusion and am resolved to act upon it."
"That must be a satisfaction to you, at least."
"No, exactly the contrary, I'm afraid. I believe I have done the right thing, but I cannot pretend it makes me happy."
Mary hesitated. It was impossible not to see that beneath his carefully maintained composure, he was very miserable. "We are told there is comfort in the knowledge that one has acted properly. Perhaps you may come to feel it later."
"Perhaps, but I doubt it."
"I do not wish to intrude, but is there any advice I can offer? If not, perhaps merely some sympathy would be welcome."
He smiled at her, and his expression, in which regret now seemed uppermost, pierced her to the heart.
"Perhaps to talk freely about what concerns you might ease your mind."
He stared at his plate, and several moments passed before he raised his eyes to hers once more. "You are very kind, but this is a matter I must deal with myself. I do not have the better of it yet, but I will." All this while, at the other side of the table, Miss Bingley had sought valiantly to persuade Mr. Ryder to accompany her to some discreet corner, where they might discuss her book of poems in greater privacy, but he had refused to be drawn, and now, her efforts exhausted, she snapped shut the little volume and looked about impatiently.
"Well, what a sorry picture we present. It is 11 o'clock, and as yet we have no plans for the day. What are your thoughts, gentlemen?"
It had probably not occurred to her that Mr. Ryder would suggest a ride into Keswick to look at the livestock market, or that Mr. Haywood would, without any real enthusiasm, agree to accompany him. But it was so, and in a few minutes Mary and Miss Bingley were left alone at the table, a situation neither of them could wish prolonged. Miss Bingley was the first to rise, leaving to seek out her sister and Mr. Hurst. Mary followed not long after, and spent her day with the gardeners, watching her uncle fish. Disregarding Mr. Ryder's advice, she took Evelina with her, hoping it would distract her from the even more anxious state of mind into which her conversation with Mr. Haywood had plunged her. But it was hardly a fair contest. Even the best author could not compete with the anxious questions that ran through her mind hour after hour about Mr. Haywood, his unhappy state, and her own possible connection to it.
Chapter 78. The night before the climb up Scafell was due to take place, Mrs. Gardiner decided she would not attempt it. The ascent was sure to be long and tedious. The guide had said the path was stony, and she did not think her ankles strong enough to bear it. Mary was straightway afraid that, at this last minute, she too would be prevented from going, but her aunt did not forbid her. She did, however, insist on her wearing a pair of thick-soled boots she had bought for her in Keswick, and arranged for one of the maids at the inn to take up the hem on her least good dress. Mary knew that in her heart Mrs. Gardiner would have preferred it if they had remained together at the inn. She often dropped hints about how comfortable they should be whilst the others were away, how they might have tea together and read their books. However, Mary was not to be persuaded. She told her aunt she was determined to see for herself the noble sights which the walk promised to deliver. But she would have divulged to no one the other reason why she would not be deterred from making the climb. There could be no doubt now that Mr. Hayward's manner towards her had changed. He was never less than polite, and gave no hint of any anger or resentment towards her. He was affable enough, but he was not the same. He no longer sought her out, as he had been accustomed to do, choosing the chair nearest her own, standing next to her at every opportunity. They rarely spoke in private now, and laughed together even less. He no longer glanced up to catch her eye across the table when something was said he knew would amuse her. Slowly but surely, he had pulled away from her. Even when he was near her, he was distant. When she was alone, Mary ran again and again over every possible explanation for his behaviour. None satisfied her. She knew him to be neither cruel nor deceitful. She did not believe him capable of acting unkindly without some cause. If she herself had played some part in his change of heart, she could not imagine what it was. Perhaps she simply imagined that he cared for her. Whilst she had longed for him to declare himself, perhaps the truth had been that her feelings were stronger than his, and now he was attempting to divest himself, with as much tact as possible, from a situation that had become embarrassing to him. Tears pricked her eyes as she considered this. She supposed it was possible. But when she thought of how happy they had been together on their first arrival in the lakes, how fond and comfortable they were with each other in the boat on Grasmere, how they had laughed about their dismal sketches, how she had teased him about his inability to tell one bird from another, she could not convince herself she had been wrong to think his affection for her was genuine. When she reached the point where there were no more possibilities to interrogate, she did not know what to do. Staring at night into the black Westmoreland dark, open-eyed when she should have been sleeping, brought no relief. Finally, she decided she would torture herself no more. No, she would act like a rational being and simply ask him why he was behaving in this way. She knew this was an audacious decision. It presumed on the nature of their acquaintance, which, although she could barely imagine now what life had been like before she met him, had not in fact been of very long duration. Nor was it usual for ladies to question gentlemen about the state of their affections. But she was resolved to do it anyway. Knowledge, she told herself, was always to be preferred to ignorance, even if what was revealed might be painful to hear. It was impossible, however, to open such a conversation at the inn. The danger of being overheard or interrupted was too great. On Scafell, though, there would be a real chance of speaking to Mr. Hayward alone, with no one to eavesdrop except the rabbits and hawks, and they were too low in the grass or high in the sky to be bothersome. She could not say with any conviction what it was she hoped to discover. She was at a loss. All she knew was that whatever had provoked Mr. Hayward's withdrawal, it did not look as if it had made him happy. For when she found ways to study him unobserved, which she very often did, he looked as troubled and preoccupied as she felt herself. On the day of the trip, the morning dawned bright and clear. Soon everything was ready, provisions packed, boots put on, the guide slipped into pockets. Mrs. Gardiner waved the walkers off, the little party squeezed tightly into the inn's hired coach.
They bumped off down the rutted roads, thankful that it was not long before they arrived at Seathwaite, where they met the guide and began their climb. The path rose up behind a small row of cottages, then levelled off into a steady incline. The ground was uneven, the grass yellow and tussocky, hiding pools of dark water which seemed designed for no other purpose than to soak the feet of the unwary walker. Mary was soon very grateful for the stout boots Mrs. Gardiner had bought her. The country was open and the sky was a sharp, bright blue, with a few tiny white clouds scattered distantly upon it. At first, they walked to the joyful accompaniment of larks singing ecstatically as they rose upwards in the clear air. But as they made their way higher and higher, they left the larks behind, and soon nothing was to be heard but the harsher cries of buzzards wheeling overhead. Mary walked alone, preferring her own company to that of anyone else. Mr. Hayward strode on, a little ahead of her, equally silent, equally alone. So now they were both unhappy, Mary thought, frowning as she watched him. And for what reason? What had soured the pleasure they had taken in each other? What had provoked such an inexplicable change of heart? With every step she took, she grew more determined to discover what had happened. The guide and his son, a fine boy of 12 or 13, led the way, setting a steady pace. Mr. Gardiner walked alongside them, questioning them intently, as was his way, about the country and the game to be found in it. Behind them followed Mr. Ryder, his excitement visible in his every eager gesture. Now and again he turned back to Mary, keen to share his enthusiasm.
"Could anything be better than this, Miss Bennet? Such skies, such air!"
His pleasure was so infectious that, even in her dark mood, Mary found it impossible not to smile mildly back, provoking an affronted glare from Caroline Bingley. She had stationed herself at Mr. Ryder's side, trotting next to him, Mary thought, exactly like an officious little terrier. She should not have been surprised if the lady had growled at her and bared her teeth. So distracted was she by Miss Bingley's hostility that Mr. Hayward's voice, low, steady, and very near to her, took her completely by surprise as he fell into step beside her. "You seem to be managing very well," he said. "It looks as though you are more than equal to the demands of the climb." Her heart beat faster to hear him speak to her in something approaching his old, familiar tone, but she was determined to keep her countenance. If she was to find the courage to question him, she must not lose her nerve. "Yes," she replied, with an evenness she did not feel, "so far, at least. But this is the easiest part. I'm sure there is worse to come." They spoke in pleasantries, quite unlike the usual bantering style of their conversation. This was painful to Mary, as it confirmed very strikingly the cooling of their relations. But she refused to allow her distress to deflect her from her purpose. If she could keep Mr. Hayward talking, the opportunity would surely present itself for her to ask him what she was to understand by his behaviour. "Mr. and Mrs. Hurst do not appear to share your stamina." Mary turned to look at the couple, labouring with some effort further down the path. "I'm sorry for them. It is clearly harder than they expected."
"I offered her my arm when we forded the stream, but she brushed me away."
"She obviously possesses in full all the gentle charm of her sister." She saw a smile steal briefly across his face, but it was quickly extinguished. It was as though he was doing all he could to resist the pull of their old ease and friendliness. She would speak. She must know the cause of it. "Mr. Hayward," she swallowed hard, determined to begin, but before she could do so, she heard footsteps behind her.
"Excuse me, Tom," exclaimed Mr. Ryder, "but I have something for Miss Bennet."
He opened his hand to show a pale yellow flower, a little crushed but still recognisable as a primrose.
"Our guide says it is one of the very last of the season. There were two flowers. I gave one to Miss Bingley, but this is for you."
"Thank you, Mr. Ryder."
"You could press it and use it as a bookmark. It might cheer up those pages of Miss Burney that you find so dreary."
With that, he strode back to his place near the head of their little procession. "Poor primroses," said Mary, gazing at the crumpled bloom. "What a sad end for such pretty things."
She looked up at Mr. Haywood. You know, I kept the honeysuckle you gave me. It is in a glass in my room. It still smells very sweet. He seemed not to hear her, absorbed in watching his friend amble back to Miss Bingley. Ryder certainly knows how to make a gesture. He will always find a way to draw attention to himself.
That seems somewhat harsh. I think he meant it sincerely.
I'm sure of it. Mary, taken aback by the bleakness of his tone, did not reply. He seems to know your tastes in reading pretty well.
I had Evelina with me the other morning. He remarked upon it. Mr. Haywood looked as though he was about to say more, but seemed to think better of it. He stood for a moment, considering, and then declared abruptly that he must ask the guide to stop soon, as he did not think the Hursts could go much further. As Mary stood watching him walk away, it burst upon her quite suddenly that Mr. Haywood was jealous. Jealous of his friend. It was such an extraordinary idea that it took a moment for her to absorb it. At first it seemed preposterous, presumptuous even. Who was she, after all, to imagine two men could feel strongly enough about her to arouse such a sensation? From a deep place in her mind, to which she had attempted to banish such dark thoughts, an old familiar whisper resurfaced to insist that only the beautiful inspired such strong emotions. A woman like her was incapable of doing so. But she could think of no other way to account for Mr. Haywood's behaviour over the last few days. His discomfort had been very marked when he had seen her in Mr. Ryder's company. His silent withdrawal when he met them walking from the inn, his obvious ill-humour just now, so unlike his usual open, frank disposition, what else could it imply but displeasure with what he regarded as his friend's overtures to her? She pulled her jacket closer to her as a strong breeze whipped around her, blowing down from the higher ground. She had remained rooted to the spot for too long. She must go on, or she would lose sight of the others. Even the Hursts were in front of her now. As Mary struggled upwards, her thoughts were so disturbed, her feelings so turbulent, that she barely noticed the path. She supposed there was one sense in which she might be encouraged by her discovery. If Mr. Haywood was indeed jealous, it suggested that his feelings for her were not entirely obliterated. If he was truly indifferent, why would he care? But the more she considered it, the more she was surprised to find that this reasoning, however logically sound, brought her neither relief nor gratitude. Instead, what she felt was a swelling indignation. What right did Mr. Haywood have to behave in this way? What possible reason did he have to be jealous? She took several deep breaths, willing herself to be calm as she picked her way carefully through the rough grass. There were large stones everywhere, strewn randomly on the ground. It would be dangerous to trip over one. All her concentration was required to avoid them, and gradually she felt more in control of herself. Very well, then. If that was the accusation, she would examine the evidence. Then she would know if there was truly a case to be answered. She was compelled to admit that Mr. Ryder's conduct did suggest some fondness on his part. His calling so regularly at Gracechurch Street implied it, as did his seeking her out so often for conversation. Indeed, the manner in which he spoke to her might be said to confirm it. A teasing familiarity, which even she understood arose from interest and affection. Mrs. Gardiner had noticed it, had warned her twice to be wary of Mr. Ryder's charm. If she had observed it, why should not Mr. Haywood have done the same? Mary's first inclination was to run ahead, find Mr. Haywood as quickly as she could, and, throwing discretion to the wind, try to convince him she felt nothing for his friend, that his apprehensions were entirely baseless. But something in her balked at the idea of it. She had done nothing wrong. She had not invited his friend's attentions, and she had certainly not returned them. If they made Mr. Haywood uneasy, why had he not spoken to her and asked if Ryder's interest was returned? She would have been happy to assure him it was not. But he had not done so. Instead, he had turned his face away from her, leaving her confused and unhappy, ignorant of the cause of his retreat. And yet she was to be the one who sought to make amends, who was meekly to apologise for an offence she had not committed. Well, she should not do it. If anyone was required to justify their conduct, it should be him. Anger was an unfamiliar emotion for Mary. In the past, she had not felt entitled to give way to anything so assertive. She had always assumed the blame for any fault, any difficulty, must be hers. Apology had become her habitual response to any form of challenge, but she no longer felt so abject. Her anger had galvanised her, had awoken her pride. Mr. Hayward had done everything possible to suggest he had strong feelings for her, given every indication that encouraged her belief that he cared for her, but nevertheless he had made no declaration. Much as she wished for it, he had not spoken. Yet he had not hesitated to show his displeasure when Mr. Ryder displayed an interest in her. Perhaps he should decide what his true feelings were towards her and express them with honesty and consistency. Then, and not before, he might have some justification for what she was now convinced was, without question, jealousy on his part.